guys are making it too much about I and me.
Because of social media, because of branding and all that.
Welcome back, coaches, to the Talking Split podcast. I am, as always, Rob Calder, as I am on every episode, joined by the woman today that smells like she's now a pack-a-day smoker, Zoe Carr. Welcome.
I feel like that needs some explanation.
We'll come back to that.
And I was really worried about where that was headed.
Well, you never know, because we are also joined by the reigning coach of the month in the Youth League competition, Darren Best. Welcome back, Bestie.
Let's talk more about how Zoe smells, I guess. That's probably more important than the Coach of the Month award.
It was a big day on the barbecue yesterday.
And obviously smoking is a big part of that. So that's the clarification. But over to you again, Bestie. Coach of the Month.
Yeah, don't know how it's worked out. Probably should have gone to somebody else.
Oh, this is a little rough. Like the humility from
self-deprecating.
Bestie.
Self-deprecating.
Yeah, no good. Like this is supposed to be like, yeah, we are the hunted. You know, we know we're going to be the hunted. We're going to win this thing. Like,
own your achievements, Bestie. It's okay to be proud.
I'm pretty sure Mihai coached all those games. No, he didn't. He didn't. But look, yeah, whatever. I'm more just proud that we won games.
Fantastic. Good to have you back on the podcast, as always. Thanks for jumping in, coaches. As a reminder, you can follow along or you can send us a message with the @TalkingSplit handle on X or Instagram. If you do have any coach shout-outs, you are more than welcome to send those in via email or via both of those apps. That would be fantastic. Written or recorded, we're happy to accept anything on that. Same with the book club. Happy to take any submissions there as well. If there's any books that you've got out there that you feel like listeners would enjoy having a read of that could help with coaching, all those types of things. Hey, just quickly before we jump into it, the Tom Brady grab off the top about players understanding the whole. I'll play the whole thing out so you can have a little bit of a listen to it.
Guys on the team, you think it's about you. It ain't about you. It's about us. And the biggest problem I see with a lot of the young players today, you guys are making it too much about I and me. Because of social media, because of branding and all that. It's fine. You're not going to win. There was a difference between being a star and being a champion.
Your talent gets you there. You know, your work ethic and your discipline takes you to where you want to be.
Every day of practice is important. You know why? Because when I was on the Patriots and we had 20 years winning, every day was a big day. I treated a preseason game, I treated a regular season like it was a Super Bowl. So when I got to the Super Bowl, it was just another day for me.
Got to know who you are, because those moments going to come. You're going to be down 28-0. You got to say, all right, I know who I am. I'm going to go get it.
I'm unrelenting. Like, I will not quit in anything I do. And I never got there on, educational background. I never got there on skill. It was work ethic and hustle.
There should be nobody in your life that should have higher expectations for you than you.
So that's a clip from Tom Brady and Jay-Z talking to the NFL rookies coming into the into the league effectively and what it's going to potentially look like. Is there anything that kind of resonates with you out of that, Bestie?
Well, a lot. We've been talking about the practice standard stuff for a while. We had a whole podcast on it pretty much. So, yeah, look, it's an age that we live in where right now everything's on social media. And, I think the most important thing to say to everyone is last year we took a tour of athletes up to the Institute. And Ash, our colleague who's an assistant coach up there, he sat there and spoke to all the kids and said, like, we don't watch any of that garbage. Like, it was a really point, like, we don't look at that when it comes to trying to recruit you to a center of excellence or an NBA global. They literally don't watch any of it. So I think that was pleasing to hear that, and reiterate it.
Yeah, absolutely. What about you, Zoe?
The big one for me was how, every game is treated like the Super Bowl or, that competitive drive. I actually mentioned it the other day. I can't remember who I said it to, but at, school basketball and you watch some of these kids and look, they are almost overscheduled. They've got a lot to do and they play a lot of basketball. But I remember I didn't go to a basketball school, but we'd have our basketball days, regional and our state and our but I went to that. I was a state team player, whatever, and I treated that like I did Friday nights, like I did when I was playing with the state team, when I was with a senior team. And it wasn't a case of I wanted everyone to know why, like I needed to justify why. It was just how I was. I was so competitive that I wasn't going to let anybody beat me ever. Now they did, don't get me wrong, but it was this real drive to just constantly be at my best. And whilst my best wasn't very good, it was still there. It was still, and so even if I wasn't outplaying you, I would outwork you. And I don't know that there's a lot of that now, and I don't know whether it's a result of overscheduling or what it is, or whether, you know, this sort of stuff, if there aren't bright lights on, you know, or people filming or things like that, you know, is it them deemed a waste of time? I'm not sure. But it's one of those things, and we say it all the time, you just never know who's watching, and you never know who knows who. And, you know, I've been asked for recommendations for kids that probably wouldn't even know that I know who they are. So, you know, people are always asking questions, and, you know,
kids outside your program too.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's not unusual definitely. For either of you to be asked about kids that aren't actually, when I say air quotes, yours, that are in your program.
Yeah.
You get the reference check.
Yeah. If you've only got 20 seconds to leave an impression with someone, what do you want it to be? And that's sort of how I was. I always felt like I'm going to play like somebody's watching.
Yep.
I've got to go back. You had a go at me about being like, I need to take the pride. You go, I wasn't very good. Okay.
Well,
clearly
I wasn't.
You were. Okay. So you could take that as
good
well.
Good enough to be the best player on a school basketball court.
Diamond Valley College, mate. We're not exactly rolling out the, the WNBA draft picks.
No, but far out. You still had a better career than most.
Anyway, that's a valid point.
Yeah, right. Anyway, we've been really pushing the practice stuff. And the biggest reason for that is, how are teams, you know, scholarships, all those things picked now? It's all like through camps. You know, even Oz stuff, as you know, like we'll have the green and gold game or whatever, but there's normally a practice the last day or whatever as well. And even, you know, Jenna had told me as well, like at an Opal selection camp, if you didn't have a great last practice at the camp, you would be a bit nervous, is what she said, because it's, you know, it's the recency bias thing. You know, it's like, so if you're not a good practice player as well, it's not just the games. So I think, you know, going back to what was highlighted in that Tom Brady thing, like every practice, everything has to be, because, you know, even when we had Mike Dunlop here, probably a couple of months ago now, yeah, he was saying, like, when I recruit players, I just want to know who's the best at practice, who wins drills all the time, who wins games all the time. It's like they don't want people that are just in and out of their commitment levels, I guess.
Well, it's one of the things I try to explain to the athletes I work with is, you know, they know there's a green and gold game because there's always, you know, photos or videos or whatever that goes up about that. But as I say to them, if you wait for the green and gold game, it's probably too late. You know, there's probably been, having been involved in it before, all the way through all the trainings, there's probably like a core group that have been selected by the time it gets to the green and gold game. If you wait to show up until the end and you're on the bubble or maybe even out, then, you know, you walk into a room and there's always the question of, was it just one good game?
Mm.
And
there's probably only three spots up for grabs by that stage, because the majority of the team has been picked.
Well, and the time you get, because you're always spending the most time on the last 2 to 3 positions.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's a real, like what Bessie's saying is spot on, because – you know, some people think that practice isn't important. It's far more important than you think if you want to get somewhere. If you're happy just going along, that's fine. You know, turn up and play and enjoy it. But if you want to progress, you need to be able to show what you can do in practice.
Yeah, without a doubt. Speaking of green and gold stuff, Bestie, so you've eventually been back for a while now. It's been a while since we've had you on the pod.
Mm.
Off to Albert Schweitzer tournament earlier this year. Give us the rundown on it. How did it come about? What is it? What is Schweitzer? What are the things you learned coming out of it? Give us the whole lot.
Yeah, I guess so. The tournament itself is it's a male tournament that's ran in Germany. It's ran, I guess, in the off year for U19 World Cup. So it's a U18 tournament. So the 2006 born mostly. There was some 2007s there from other countries. Australia didn't take any 2007s because it was right at the time of the under 18 national championship. So some of those kids, you know, I think will feature in the EMUs going forward, whether it's Asia Cup, World Cup, whatever. But they didn't go to that tournament, I guess, because BA didn't want to mess with.
Yeah, don't disrupt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, it was opportunities for some other kids. So, yeah, it was a three-day camp prior to departure. So we went in, we had a three-day camp up there, and then we left. It was a, you know, a pretty hectic schedule across those 3 days. I think we did five sessions. So we had five sessions together, which isn't a lot when you're preparing for a tournament like that. Some of the benefit was, though, there was quite a few kids that were at the Institute or had been at the Institute previously. There was also some of the kids that had been away with that same age group to Oceania's previously. So a lot of the stuff was similar, I guess. So, yeah, we had five sessions. Then we got on the plane. We tried to get on the plane. Our flights kept getting delayed and cancelled and all that type of stuff, which is pretty normal now. Yeah. So it was a pretty big trip, you know, obviously going that far, as you guys would know, you just did it. But, yeah, we went Canberra, Melbourne, Perth, Heathrow, London Heathrow, Frankfurt, and then on the bus for about an hour. We actually got on the wrong bus at one point, and then, yeah, it was, yeah, anyway. So that's all part of international travel. And then we had a day of practice, and then we played the Germany U17 team in a practice game, which was good. And then, yeah, then it started, and I honestly didn't know what to expect from a, you know, from where we sat standpoint. You know, we obviously went all the way through undefeated and then won the thing for only the second time ever in Australia's history, which was, you know, phenomenal to be a part of that. Both Robbie and Ash, you know, did a really good job with the kids that had, you know, they'd been in touch with before. And I just tried where I could to help with some of the video stuff and, you know, the scouting and practice and everything like that. But gameplay, it was interesting, that type of tournament, because it wasn't just American teams or it wasn't just European teams or Asian teams. You know, that we had a mixture. So, you know, we had Japan in our pool, we had Turkey in our pool, you know. So then to get through those games was good, and every game, every team posed a different challenge, you know, style wise, personnel wise, all of that, which is, I guess, in essence,
spectator wise.
Oh, well, definitely that. Yeah. You know, there was a few fights in the crowd, and you know, even the final, we had a bottle thrown at our bench from the Serbian fans, and someone stormed the court during the closing ceremony while they were playing the anthem to try and start a Serbia chant. But yeah, look, just all of that was just, you know, just part of an awesome experience to do that. And, you know, Germany, I've been there a few times. It's an awesome place. You know, I could very easily live there. You know, I like the efficiency side of it. Yeah. But yeah, look, just really good for those players, and obviously to go over there. And we as everybody knows, you know, we had, you know, Rocco, who was the tournament MVP, and I think he's probably going to go to the NBA next year. You know, and then Roman, obviously, as well. He was All-Star 5 for the tournament as well, and he's just signed a next star deal with Tassie. So you have those two guys, and then a really great group of complementary players for them, you know, like, and they're all going to be fine in their own right as well. And most of them probably pro potential also, but the mixture of all that just worked really well.
Yep.
Yeah.
What were the biggest takeaways for you in the tournament? Like, did you see anything that would change how you would run your program here, or anything you'd teach differently coming out of it?
I don't think anything I would teach differently. You know, it's just everything's bigger, faster, stronger, you know. So the guards that were smaller were uber skilled, like uber skilled, really good shooters, you know, and tough, really tough. A lot of the other countries were actually a little bit more physically developed, I felt. You know, like their gym work was probably more substantial than ours, I would say. Style of play-wise, everyone, like the Euros was – they all had multiple action into action, you know, so it was a lot of like ram screens or staggers into ball screen, or, you know, a zipper screen into a ball screen. And they were really good at just getting their main guys in the action all the time. So we obviously did a good job scouting that. You know, I think the importance of practicing, being able to apply a scout. You know, so we've been doing a bit of that, even this last block with SDP, with defending some actions, sort of even though you know it's coming sort of thing. But, you know, the group did good, you know. So obviously we would, Ash and I, we would stay up and we'd do the scout and then we'd have practice and we'd present it. And then, you know, we had the best defense there at the tournament. So that, you know, that obviously helped. But, yeah, just the size, the importance of length, you know, like the teams are rolling out legitimate length. And so did we. So, you know, that's important. And I guess for everyone listening, you know, a bit of an understanding around, once again, our programs need to be a mix of that. It's, you know, we want success at nationals and all of that, but ultimately we're here to have long-term potential. So that's why we have some players in our program that maybe aren't the best players, or they're in a twos or a threes right now. But when you go and look at some of those body shapes that we played against, that's how they are. So, yeah, and then obviously from just different ways to present a scout, you know, just the video package, the way that they wanted it. And I've adopted some of that as well. I think it's good. Awesome experience, good group of kids, and, you know, made the flight home a lot better. But when you're coming away from that, everyone had a turn, like having to look after the trophy. So yeah, it was good.
You always want the extra leg room if you can swing it on those flights. But yeah, I mean, phenomenal experience, obviously. Yeah, and that's kind of the big thing. Like, I think we've all been, and most people listening have probably experienced this too, the game looks very different from the third level up, row G, seat 22, than it does to two rows back.
Yeah.
Down the very front. It's just, the game is faster, bigger, stronger. You hear people hit each other and it's like, oh, that one must have stung. Like, it's just, the game is so different when you're that close to it. I think we can all see it on TV and we all have our opinions on how it should be played and those types of things, but until you're there and you see it, it's such a different world.
Yeah, and extremely loud. You know, like everyone was banging drums and playing music and chanting the whole, you know, depending on which, you know, team you played. You know, Turkey was crazy. When we played Germany's U18 team, it was, you know, 4,000 people there or whatever, and it was loud. And we're literally, you know, they've got those what are they, those LCD screens or whatever in front of you. And I'm literally leaning over it, like screaming at the top of my lung, the offense that they've called, because a lot of it was hand signals and stuff like that. It was just, you're really in it in that moment. Like, nothing else is a concern to you. So you would know that, Zoe. Like, it was awesome. And then to win it, it was great, you know, to beat those teams.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Unreal. All right, great experience. All right, moving into the actual topic of the podcast as we jump into it now. So we're looking at things that we think might be under-taught areas of the game. So we know coaches are time poor. We don't have our kids every day. We get them for potentially an hour at actual training, an hour of a game. You might get a second session in there if you're lucky. Do you get a full court, half court, those types of things. So acutely aware of all the reasons that it is difficult to coach our junior athletes in particular. So we're certainly not having a crack at anyone here or anything like that. I promise you, we understand. We've all been through that ourselves as coaches. But we are going to look at a couple of things that we do think might be undertaught that we could focus in a little bit more of our time into. The first one, and I think it's purely because I think we're going to go the longest on it, is decision-making and IQ. You know, it's just such a broad topic, obviously, but when you sort of hear that, Zoe, like, what are the things that immediately jump to mind, and how do you go about teaching it?
Yeah, well, the first ones that jump to mind for me are point guard play. I think we spend a lot of time, because of the way our setup is, particularly here in Victoria, where we need to win. We've got to win. Everybody needs to win. We end up taking over, and
as a coach, you're saying,
as a coach, yeah. And so we're taking away the ability for our point guards in particular to make decisions as to what are we running and why. I think sometimes, as well as challenging them, so they'll run an offense, and I've seen it a lot. I even saw it over the weekend. They'll run an offense, it'll work, but the shot doesn't go in. So the point guard will call a different offense. And that's where we've got to really get in there and say, hey, no, go back to it. It worked. We just missed the shot. Let's keep going to something until it's stopped. And then you look to make your adjustments. But I think we, as coaches, we've taken over a little bit. So we start calling every single play. And the last thing we want are point guards that are getting the catch and then looking at the coach. We need point guard. Like, it's one of the things when I think of, like, Christy Harawa, one of the most elite point guards we've ever had, mostly because she knew what to run, who to, and why. Like, you asked her any of those, she'd be able to, on every single offense, she'd be able to give you an answer. And she played with LJ and Penny Taylor. So getting them their shots was really important because they were two of the best players in the world. So she knew how to do that, how to manage that, and how to run the group. So I think that's something that we're probably under-teaching, and it's not easy, and you have to wade through a bit of rubbish to get to it. But that's coaching, I suppose, in anything. And from a decision-making perspective, I think, you know, we talk about it a lot when we're, you know, particularly end-of-penetration decisions. So I see a lot of premeditated movement, whether it be, and when I say penetration, I mean off the dribble, I mean post moves, I mean, you know, anything like that, where it's, I'm going to make this move rather than what's the defense giving me so I can take that. And yeah, again, it's hard. I played in the post my whole career. Everyone's probably laughing because I'm like 5'10". And because of that size, I had to think and take what I could get. So for mine, something to help is if you can try and find bigger, longer for athletes to go against, then you can't just bully and shoot over the top. So for girls, it might be trying to find some boys to come in and defend them, or for, you know, your boys, it might be men, or, you know, that sort of stuff, just to really get them thinking about, you know, where is the D, where is my advantage, okay, and seeing through, you know, second and third lines of defense rather than just I'm putting the ball to the floor, head down, butt up, I've got my feet in the paint, well, I've decided I'm going to shoot this even though three players have collapsed on me. So putting them in those positions as much as possible in practice where it's safe to then hopefully transfer into games.
I don't know, it's something you spoke about it previously, Bestie, like the end of penetration decision making. Like, we know a lot of our guards go in just kamikaze style and hoping that the ref will bail them out with a foul. But it's that teaching at the end of being able to not just say, well, it's not just about me scoring, but have I drawn two or three? Can I find who the next player is?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how is there anything you use to teach that? Like, is it, say, the small side of games at practice? Like, what are the constraints you use, those types of things?
Yeah, pardon me. We've done some stuff around, you get a point for a score, but you get a point for an open shot as well. So, like, if you change the type of scoring, now, obviously, that's not going to work in a, you know, in a game as such, but if you practice that way, then hopefully those habits take over. But I think that's...
If only we got rewarded for the moral victories in basketball.
Yeah, we'd all be... You know, feeling much better about ourselves some weekends. But, yeah, I think that's important. You know, generating an open shot, celebrating a good possession, you know, the process, not the outcome. We've all spoke about that stuff before. But the game awareness stuff, Zoe, is super important. I think not just that position, but everybody. You know, like, what's the time on the clock? What's the score? What's the situation? What's the foul count? You know, we see that a lot at the end of quarters, end of games, you know, managing the clock. And you can practice that with some scenario-based stuff at your games and then at practice. And then further more to what Zoe said is you can have some conversations around your players, with your players, like, right, this is the situation, there's 2 minutes left. Maybe then that's when you challenge a point guard in the group, like, what are we running and why? You know, so maybe that can help. But I see that as a, you know, as a big issue, you know, people, you know, just not being able to read the flow of the game, I guess, you know, and take some bad ones, or you know, foul when they shouldn't foul, and just you know, pressuring up the floor when there's, you know, 5 seconds left on the clock but they're in the bonus and you foul them, you know, just stuff like that we need to get better at. As general, going, you know, onto that decision-making stuff. But the end of penetration decision stuff is, until they stop getting rewarded with fouls, you know, like when we're at practice, you know, we don't call them. We just allow them to get hammered and land on the ground, you know. And we're like, well, you should have passed it, dude.
Yep.
I think a big part of it too is when I used to do this as a coach, I used to give the answer. So I would say, stop, she's open, or, you know, that sort of thing, and give that answer instead of stop, what can you see?
Mm.
You know, and a big...
Prompted a little bit more.
Yeah, and a big thing I say to my athletes all the time is you don't always have to give it, but you do always have to see it, because it's like a tunnel. You know, they put the ball to the floor and that's it. Everything shuts down and it's me in the basket and we don't see anything else. So you've always got to see it. But we've got to, I think a really good line I stole from you, Rob, was show them where to look but not what to see.
I stole it from someone else. I'd love to take credit for that, but I think it was a Michael Gervais line off the top of my head.
But it's a really big starting point is to get them to look through elbows. You know, if there's any penetration from that top, and so if you're from the top, you're looking obviously through the top elbow. If you're from a baseline penetration, you're looking through the opposite elbow, and you should be able to see everything from there. And, you know, if you spend 10 seconds talking to Coops about anything, scanning will come up, and it's really important because, like, he hits the nail on the head. You know, he talks about the importance of scanning, seeing not only, because you've got to see not only offense, but you've got to see the D, and you've got to be able to make those decisions. And if you're just looking one way, then, you know, you're not going to be able to make the right decision. So you've got to be constantly scanning the floor. So I think it's really important that instead of giving them the answers, let's drag the answers out of them so there's more of a chance of them to see it the next time. And as Bestie said, find ways to reward, you know, that extra pass or whatever it is, or in general the right decision, because I think sometimes too the right decision is to go to the rim or to score, and we get so caught up on making, you know, 2 foot stop, make the pass, and they were actually the one in the best position to score. So, you know, if you can find a way to give extra points for the decision, I think is a really good way of going about it.
Well, and realistically too, it's also a case of you'll get one-on-one in the key to be able to make that decision if you make a couple of passes out. Mm. All of a sudden the D will stretch on that inherently. It tends to happen, and that's why we talk about small-sided games a lot, the 2-on-1, 3-on-2, 4-on-3 type stuff. The advantage where you have to make quick decisions like on the go, like you are trying to make it work, like throw the assists like an extra point. Or something like that. Like if they throw a behind the back pass to get it somewhere, that you sort of sit there and go, geez, I don't know that they should have really got it there, but they've obviously been able to see it. That's rewarding the awareness of what's going on around them too. And that's such a big part of it. The second you reward something and validate it in front of the rest of the team, watch how everyone else in your group sits there and says, oh, that's actually okay. Like I can do this. Now I'll start doing for it as well. You only have to reward it once.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Like I've done it before. I've cheated in drills. Shock horror. But it's like, hey, first person to get to 7, someone throws a pass that we've been trying to get them to throw for 4 weeks. It's like, you get 7 points, you win the drill straight away. Mm. Like, we're done. And all of a sudden, everyone's like, oh, that's not fair. And it's like, yeah, okay, it's not fair, but achievement. Like, reward it once, and then all of a sudden, everyone will start doing the same thing. So it's a really big area. Just tapping back into your time and score stuff, Bestie. Always watch games with other people if you can. Like, if you have that ability to watch games, like, and obviously Zoe and I are in a unique situation, like, you, Bestie, with Ish as well, you could probably do this. You watch a game and you start to have that conversation around, well, what would you do here? What would you change? Mm. I know we were watching a game on Friday night, the Diamond Valley Knox game, NBL 1, and it was a close game all the way through, and we got to have that conversation continually about, would you advance it here? Would you foul it here? Who would you foul in this sort of situation? For the love of God, throw it to Jock Perry. Like all those types of conversations we got to have throughout it. Yeah. But that's great learning for you as the coach as well. So it's not just about the players, but you as the coach has to be across the time in the school.
Yeah, definitely. It's always easier watching it, for sure. But you've got to be
stress and
you've
sweat on
be
our
prepared. You've got to be prepared to be able to think that way. So you've got to practice it,
yep.
You know. And it's the same, you know, with the decision making stuff. If you're doing it half pace at practice, you can't expect them when, you know, they're playing flat out in a game to make those decisions correctly when it's faster. You know, so you got to practice that way. And I know it's nothing new. You know, if you don't practice, you know, you got to practice the way you want to play, or practice should be harder, all those types of things. But I, you know, I attend a lot of practices, and I think we're letting our players down with that stuff.
Yep. I think on the one of the things when you talk about reward, absolutely. I think on the other side, though, there's got to be not so much punishment, but, you know, if you've got an advantage, and it's one of the things we work on a lot, is if we've got an numerical advantage, we've got to keep it and then exploit it quickly. So if you're running a drill that's 3-on-2 or whatever, and there's more than maybe 2 passes, turnover. Mostly because you're not going to get that in a game. The reason you've got your numerical advantage is someone might have fallen over, or someone's just quite slow, but they're coming. So if we don't get it quickly, or make those decisions quickly, it's gone. Or as you get older, rotations and closeouts become better, and again, it's gone. So learning how to really exploit those advantages by, you know, not allowing 6 passes to go. Of course, they're eventually going to score if they've got that numerical advantage, or send that extra defender in as you start to build it up, depending on age. Send the extra defender in, and if it gets to back to neutral, so back to 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5, turnover. Because our aim should always be to exploit any advantage that we've got.
Well, there's a great clip yesterday. I say yesterday, we're on a Tuesday. Out of the Boston-Dallas game, and I'll throw it up on the Talking Split Twitter account, of they were in the timeout with Joe Mazzulla, who's the Boston Celtics head coach. And he spoke about exactly that. Playing fast is fantastic, but once it gets to 5-on-5, we don't need to still be playing as fast as we are in transition. And it was just, it got to a point in the game where it was a little bit chaotic. Dallas had started to make a little bit of a run at the same time. It's like, hey, just understand the time, the space, the score, the tempo. We don't need to win this game in the second quarter. We need to win it in the fourth quarter, but we can lose it in the second quarter. It's one of those types of moments too. On the end of penetration decision-making stuff, we've spoken pretty much exclusively about the offensive side of it, but the defensive side of it as well. Huge. Don't bail out by fouling.
Yep.
For the love of God, go vertical. Like,
oh no, it's the one that's the worst is split line comes across and they wall up, they do a great job, and someone sticks their hands in from behind, the person who's been beaten. That's the one that makes my eye twitch.
It's a great way of explaining it. I've seen that look a couple of times, as it turns out. But, like, Bestie, what are the things you are talking about? Because it's similar to what Zoe's saying, like, don't stick a paw in there, obviously. But defensively, end of penetration, what are you looking for from your defenders?
Well, foul discipline is the biggest one. Like, if you've done your job, you know, you've got them down to low shot clock, whatever. But yeah, we see, you know, the reaching is a huge one. And, you know, after being away again, like going back to the Switzer stuff, they did let, you know, a fair bit of that stuff go. But if you played with your chest, it was like just play on, you know, like if you could almost run them over with your chest, and it was just, you know. But walling up has become a term that we hear coaches yelling out, and I'm the same, like wall up, wall up, wall up. And then the player just goes around him. Like, I don't know if you've seen that, right? Yeah. So being able to, you know, particularly on pivots, you know, like guarding pivots is something that we're really poor at. Like, they'll pivot and then we'll move away from basket side, and then they'll just step through and score. So I see that a lot. I saw a lot on the weekend too. So it's understanding which foot's the pivot foot, walling up, and when to wall up, you know, not walling up, you know, and becoming a statue so they just go right around you. How to jump and wall up, you know, verticality, when to leave the floor. And then probably the last one is like finishing the possession. So whether it's blocking out or taking away the bailout pass, or, you know, someone's dribbled it, they've picked it up, they're guarding the pivots well, and everyone's just watching, and then there's a back cut for a layup. So like that type of stuff.
Yep. That makes a lot of sense. The other one we were talking about just before we jumped on was the whiteboard transfer.
Yeah.
That you spoke about from the decision-making perspective. You want to talk us through that?
Well, it starts with coaches, us, really. So when you're using the whiteboard, and we've all had it, like, you know, I had one last game where I, after I was wiping it off the whiteboard, I'm like, ugh, you know.
That's coach of the month right there.
Let's see how we go. Let's see how we go.
His players got him there.
You know, 100% they did, yeah. But so having some consistency with how you draw things, so whether it's, you know, numbers and or letters or whatever it is, and then, you know, dotted lines, straight lines, squiggly lines, like what do they all mean? You know, I just use what's on fast draw. You know, so whatever's on fast draw, that's what I use. That's how I do my whiteboard stuff. Because if I was to ever give somebody a playbook, it'd be what was on fast draw. So, so some consistency with that. But then also it helps the players understand, well, that is a pass or that is a drive or whatever. So the ability to take something off the board in, and then what Zoe was talking about too, like the ability to be able to show it one way on the board and then maybe the like it's on the other side of the floor or whatever sometimes. I've got a couple of players right now that if I draw it, I know mid timeout I can't say, oh, actually you go and run that spot. Like I just know for a couple of players it's like they're done. I may as well sub you out and actually put somebody else in, you know. But that's important, you know, to be able to take something off the board and your ability to be able to do that in practice. And you should be able to practice that with your time score situational games at the end of, you know, at practice or whenever you're doing that. You should have a whiteboard and say, hey, over here, we're doing this off the board. And whether it's, you know, depending on the level, you don't want to have something too different from what you're doing, you know, like if it's young kids, but if you're, you know, seniors or state teams or whatever, maybe it is a different alignment to begin with if it's off the board or whatever it might be. But to be able to do that builds trust with coaches, and then you want to have them on at the end of the game.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. It's funny, the game we were watching on Friday night, we saw a team come out of the timeout, and I don't know if the ball changed from where it was supposed to be going or what the story was, but we saw one of the point guards like directing traffic, like, no, you got to come and stand over here, get over here.
Yeah.
Like, this has to happen over here. And there's a real proud moment because we've actually had a little bit to do with the player. And it's like, oh, thank God they've remembered something that we taught them. But it's amazing how often the point guards have to fix the bigs.
Well, and that's
did it result in a score?
I don't remember. I'll say yes, but I don't actually remember off the top of my head.
But I think one of the things that's important when we talk about under taught skills is exactly that, the ability for players to be able to communicate to their
peers
I guess, about what they need and what they want. So it's something that I find a bit of a battle is that, you know, we had it just a few Saturdays ago. We were running a transition drill and our big had been running the floor just unbelievably well, ceiling wide open, and not once was she looked at. So we got into the discussion at the end about it, and I said, someone's been running the floor, and I was looking at the roof because I didn't want to look at anyone in particular and give them the answer, and I told them that's why I was doing it. I said, and she was open 9 times out of 10 and was not once looked at. I hope she's got the courage to step up and say, that was me. And she didn't, which is fine, but her defender did and said, yeah, that was her because I was stuck behind her the whole time.
Self-awareness on point from the defender.
But then we got into a discussion about, hey, if you're open like that and you've done the work and you are a foot from the basket, you have to be able to go into the huddle and say, I'm open on this. You know, and it's, again, the same thing. You don't have to give it, because sometimes, particularly as post players, we feel like we're open, but we can't see what's behind us or those sort of things. But you have to at least see it. And it's a bit of a skill, I think, to be able to teach how to not only give them create the environment that they feel they can go into the huddle and say, hey, I'm open, or hey, let's look at this, but also then how to take that message as well. So sometimes as young females, we get a little bit confronted by that from peers. So being able to go, hey, like, this is all about making us better as a team and helping us to be more successful. So that peer-to-peer coaching, I think, is really, really important and something we need to do more work on.
Agree.
Yeah, I like that. And realistically, if you are the person that's open and you say nothing, you're complicit. Like you're just as much at fault as the people that aren't throwing you the ball in that place.
Yeah, but so it's a skill too, because you can't walk into that huddle and say, "Get me the ball," like, because I probably wouldn't pass it to you if you spoke to me like that.
You've been iced out on the next few possessions.
Fake it to you, well, almost comically, and then kick it on. No, but it's a skill on how to be able to have that communication and obviously receive it.
Yeah, and sometimes that needs to be some coach ownership given over to the players at practice. Okay, I'm not going to give you the answers here. I'm going to give you the situation. 4 seconds to go. It's their ball on the baseline. You've got a break. Go sort it out.
Well, we've also done full drills where there's no coach involvement at all. So it's – and I've told them, we are not helping you in this drill. So if you need something, it's up to you. And you see at the start it's very standoffish, but by the end they're starting to work together and talk and and it's good, but it's being consistent with that.
That stuff's awesome to do in preseason.
Yeah.
That type of stuff, yeah.
Absolutely. And you've had it a little bit in the past too, Zoe, where you've had injured players jump in and coach the scrimmage.
Yep.
So rather than the coach always being the one giving the answers, having to take that peer-to-peer coaching. So even if you've got subs, you get them that opportunity to start talking to other players, but also receive feedback from other players, which, you know, clearly vital in what we do. All right, we'll move on from the decision-making in IQ. We'll look at defense in particular. So I'll combine two of these. So the two that I had was full court defense and staying in front of the ball. So we'll combine those into the one area, so to speak. How do you teach full court defense on a half court? Difficult to do, to be completely fair, but there are ways around it. What have you used in the past, Zoe, to help teach this?
So I've often used playing, basically breaking it into, okay, we're going this way. Yep. I'm pointing, terrible use for an audio medium. We're going from an inbound, for example.
Baseline towards half court, yep.
And how we defend that, get to our positions. Once we get to the half court, you then have to, offense hands it over to the D, and now defense are coming back on offense. So now they're having to flip into their half court or front court defensive rules, and obviously giving both teams a go at that. It's really difficult. I think a lot of it, though, is really taught mid-game. You know, you've really got to coach the hell out of it during the game, because whilst it is doable in the half court, it's not ideal. The other thing I would say is if you've got, you know, if you're the twos and the ones are at the other end or vice versa, overlap your session so you can get some full court. So we're all trained together for, you know, half an hour, 90-minute session, for example. We're an hour by ourselves. We'll overlap for half an hour and then, you know, so you can get that full court up and down. But I think the really big thing is being consistent with your message and your rules during the game. So if we've all seen it, you've got a player that sticks their hands in all the time, and especially in the backcourt, like they go for the steal. And you've been working and working to say, hey, play through the chest blows, you know, force them to the sideline, whatever your rules are. And then in the game, they stick their hands in and it just happens to work. And the crowd all goes nuts and everyone's you're up against it there. There's got to be that reminder of, hey, you know, we want to play through the chest there, be the defense that leads to the steal, all that sort of stuff, just to try and inspire good habits. But yeah, it is incredibly difficult on a half court to be able to do that. But the most gameplay that – more gameplay or
live action
stuff that you can put into your session, I think the better you're going to come out of it.
Yep. Yeah, we've been doing this block or this pass block that just ended, no offensive score counted unless we had D-trans positions. So – shot would go up and in, we'd have to get, you know, guard to the nail, someone back, you know, to halfway. So that's one way to at least start it. Like Zoe said, not every time you have the same gender, or maybe it's even, you know, a team that's comparable to you on the other end, but you could still break it up and play some three-way reps where you go half down back, then the other group goes half down back. I have to touch on it, you know, the only way we're going to get better at full court man-to-man defense is by playing it, guys. Like, you know, I went to the tournament this weekend at the Classic and I saw several teams like on the tip like run back into the zone, you know.
And that's the classic.
Yeah, and it's, you know, there's players, you know, I'm largely speaking, you know, about Metro teams, you know, pleasing to see a lot of Vic teams, you know, make it through to, you know, games that, you know, have a chance to win medals or whatever. But, you know, there's players on those teams that potentially haven't been picked for our stuff, you know, state teams or whatever, because they can't defend one-on-one well and they're playing for a club that they run back and play zone. You know, so it's you know, I understand, like, we all from time to time use zone, you know, like it's a good tactical thing and there's always a time for it and, you know, tournament play and all of that stuff, you know, like save legs and I get it. But what I will say is we must have seen, like, less than 5% of zone at Schweitzer. I'm just telling you that, and that those kids are 1 year out of under-18s, and we're at camp. It's like, well, you know, we can't put this kid on the floor during the game because he can't stay in front of the ball, or he fouls every time he goes on because he can't guard. So that, like, that's a big issue. The only way we're going to get better at it is by doing it, and going for back to Zoe's point about, you know, the need to win, and I understand that. I'm not saying, you know, I've played zone, but to see it from the tip, you know, and for 80% of a game, you know, it's not just one team, it's not just one coach, you know, it's a collective. Yep. You know, we've got to get better at it. And it's not just a Victorian thing. You know, like, we had our HP meeting after one of the under 16 nationals, I think.
Yep.
And we spoke about, you know, we need to try it. Like, I think, you know, you get into under 16s and it's like, well, we can do this now. And it's like, it's effective, you know. But we spoke about it as a cohort, trying to limit the amount of zone played at AJCs a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and I think we came out of one of those meetings and, you know, as a group, as a national high performance collective, decided our January tournaments are going to be zone free.
That's right, actually, yeah.
Unless you've got, you know, injuries, four players, whatever.
Yeah.
Obviously being reasonable. But, like, I don't agree with all matchup all the time.
No,
I agree.
But I think we've got to get to a point where matchup defense is going to be what gets you successful. Like, I'm thinking back to last year with under-19 Worlds. And the teams in the top half were not running a zone.
Correct.
At all. Bottom half, yes, but top half, absolutely not. And if they did, it was like a little half-court trap maybe that was out of a timeout and it was one possession. Like, that sort of stuff, using it tactically, using it, you know, just to try and change a flow or slow some momentum and then get back into your matchup or some version of matchup. You know, it shoots me back to, I was coaching under 18s what feels like an eternity ago, and there were three main teams, us, Bulleen and Melbourne Tigers, and that was going to be who fights off for the final. And Melbourne Tigers and Bulleen were winning games by 40 and 50, and we were only really winning games by 15 to 20.
What a horrible feeling that must have been.
No. But the reason being, or one of the reasons being, that I was trying to challenge them with different defensive things. So sometimes it'd be, okay, we're three possessions in full court matchup. Then on any score, we're in, you know, a half court trap back into a matchup, which is switching, which was far too much information for them. But that was the point. Like, it was, you know, our defensive coverage on an on-ball screen for everybody is this, except this particular player, it's that. And that's hard for 16 and 17-year-olds, but that's how... That's the point,
that's
right?
That's what the game is. Yeah.
So it was helpful for us because we were probably the third best team out of that list, but ended up making the final because when it came to it, we had to do some funky stuff on D when, you know, when it was come finals time and we were ready. So it's one of those things that, you know, I know we talk about it probably every week. It's hard to give up winning for the sake of development, but it really does, like in the long term, it does come out your way eventually.
Yeah, I'm not for a second saying don't play zone.
Yep.
The percentage is the issue. Yeah. The percentage of it played.
We watched one of the games and I think one of the teams was 32 minutes. Oh, yeah, is it 32?
I think it was
the full game. Basically.
Yeah, the full game. Yeah. The full game was in a zone and it was really disappointing because you just, how are those kids getting better?
They're not.
You know?
Yeah. And that's the issue. And for us, when it comes to selections, with state, it's like they can't guard.
Mm.
Yeah, and I
they're
do
not
feel
getting better at it.
Yeah, I do feel for the kid in that situation 100%. As well, because as coaches, we're hanging them out to dry. Because, and look, we know structured presses, zones, and those sorts of things, they will hide your bad defenders. Like, you can put some parameters around it so that you can find a way. But if you're going to be good at those types of defenses, it should really start with defense being the backbone of just your matchup D.
Mm.
That will give you the tools to go and be able to play within structures. And I get it from the other side, and I promise you, we do have a podcast coming up. This is going to be like the Devil's Advocate podcast, but we're going to try and counter-argument everything that we've been talking about for so long.
Besties jam, yeah, I know. He's right there.
Just looking for arguments on a Tuesday, his bestie. But it's one of those things where it's like, well, look, we get it. The argument is always, well, your job is as the coach is to beat it. It's tactical. It's like, yeah, but should it be? Like, are you putting everything that you hold holy as coaching, which is develop our players, make sure they're enjoying it, progression, like engagement aside to just get a win?
Yes, it should be your job in seniors.
Yeah, no problems. Honestly,
in juniors, we're in developmental phase.
Yep.
And so that's where they've got to – and yes, they need to learn how to play against a zone. Absolutely they do. But in that phase of their development, 32 minutes of a zone, you're not only hurting your players. Like, I remember I was a big push for the under-12 zone ban coming in. And I was coaching under-12s at the time, and the final, you know, nail in the coffin for it was, like, I was getting frustrated because I was doing all this work on form and technique, and then the only shot we could get was like a 3.
It's heaved up.
Because we had no bigs. And so it was this disgusting because, of course, we had the size 6 at that stage as well, so made it harder. But the other side, we were playing a team that had this tall, long, amazing-looking athlete who stood under the basket for, again, 32 minutes or however long the games are. And it was like, she's not getting any better. Like, and when we were in any type of transition, she couldn't guard her lunch money because she didn't know how. If she wasn't under the basket, there was no understanding of any matchup principles. So it was like, That's what we're talking about here. We're talking about trying to develop them to be able to aspire to what they want to try and get to. Once you get to seniors, I still don't like it, but it's a little bit of a case of all bets are off, right?
Well, it's personal,
like,
preference by the time you get that stage. Look, you'd see zone in youth league.
Lots.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we see a bit because we're pretty good at the moment.
Yep.
But yeah, I just go back to, so for me, when I went to the Classic this week, I'm going there to look, like, if we just think the under 18 age group, celebrate the kids that have been through our program and to see some of those top ages play well. And, you know, was really happy for the Dandenong kids that, you know, like Henry and Ned and Austin and those guys that have been through our program and they've aged out essentially now, you know, they're top age 18. So see them do really well. Awesome. But I'm going there right now. I'm like, I'm looking at the 08. It's like, who can do well for next year? Who can maybe make a state team? Same as with the under 16s. I'm going to see those kids that are in our state team right now. What do I need to go to Dom and his staff? Well, hey, this kid maybe struggled a little bit with that. We need to fix that over the next month. And then I'll look at the kids that maybe were on the bubble but didn't make it. What do we need to get them to do, you know, to make it next year or the following year? And it's really hard to get an evaluation of them. It's like, well, they just went and ran and stood back and like played the bottom right side of the zone, you know. So
they at least followed instructions.
Well, so from that perspective, it's hard. And I will say, you know, once again, we get asked for lists. So from the next level up, you know, the COE, global guys, whatever, like, what players should we look at the Classic? And it's like, well, if I give them a name and they go, well, they just sat in a zone the whole time. It's like, you know, it's not great. It's not great. Now, do it 50% of the game if you have to. But this, like, literally there were some teams where it was like the jump ball and run back.
Mm.
You know, so it's hurting them It's really hurting them.
And that's the thing. Like, you're not asking for this from a talent ID perspective. Like, what you are asking for it is that when that kid comes into camp, give them the tools so that they can be successful at that camp by seeing it replicated in a game situation. They shouldn't come to a camp and hear for the first time, we want you to guard in the full court, we want you to pin the ball to a sideline, we want you to chest blow and keep it in front, because all they see is zones. Like, it's not a talent ID perspective. Like, it's a slant on it for sure. But you're really hurting the kid, and that's who I really feel for in all of this. Like, no win is more important that we can sacrifice a player's development.
Yeah. And it's just not what's done at the level that they want to go to.
Yep.
You know, like the NBL, college, national teams, whatever. Some teams do it. You know, like, everyone knows, oh, well, Syracuse. Yeah, right. That's one out of 350 Division I schools that just, like, are known for a zone, you know. Was it Japan or Korea or what, on the women's side, was it?
Yeah, Japan played a good challenge.
Well, yeah, but they also did their, like, three-way switching all that, which, like, for a lot of people would think it's a zone, but it's not. But anyway, so, you know, it's all – there are niche groups that do it.
Yep.
No doubt.
Completely agree.
And at a junior athlete development, you got to try and expose them to everything.
Yep. Well, and ultimately, if you've got solid matchup principles and skill set, you'll be able to fall into any zone, no problem.
Yeah. So not to we've probably said enough on it, but the only way to get better at playing full court man to man is by playing full court man to man. Like, it's just
absolutely. And now when we look at the half court, closeouts are obviously a really big part of the half court defensive position. Now, I have been a big proponent of this, so I'll throw the asterisk on this and say I've been screwing this up myself. Not that you can't do it, but be very mindful of how you start a drill or an activity or whatever it is that you're using in training. That Chris Paul start, so where the defender is facing the basket, the offense stands behind them with the ball on their back and they play live. Yes, it gives the offensive player an advantage, but by the same token, are you working on the defensive closeout? No. And, like, I've found all sorts of different quirky ways to start drills and, like, little breakdowns and all those types of things, like the scarecrow stuff, whether you had a basketball in each hand, the offense can pick one out, all that sort of stuff. Tons of different ways to do it. But what I have been probably letting my kids down on is we're not working on the closeout enough. I need to do a better job of that. I'm not saying you can't use them, but just try and find the balance between the two of how you start what you're doing. It might be a toss the ball out, go close it out, touch it, play it live. That might be a more efficient way of starting to get the closeout back into it, because the disadvantage drills are great, but if we only advantage the offense, we're actually hindering the defense to start the possession, which is the closeout.
Well, I think what's really important there is that, you know, yes, we want to always try and, when we're talking decision-making and we give them the advantage, et cetera, the next layer to that should be now create your own advantage as well. So it's not a case of you've been given an advantage. Now you've got to create something and, you know, you work on your principles from there. But completely agree. And one of the things that I've really, please try not to do is tag out. So if you're going to close out or you reverse the ball, for example, and there's going to be penetration and you're working on your rotationals, have them, you know, step their foot outside the three-point line on one side, because, again, that's creating a really poor habit. Try and, you know, whip the ball quicker if you need to, you know, allow passes through so it moves quicker so they're, you know, on that flight of the ball so they have to close out. Any closeout should be an advantage anyway. So, you know, then, yeah, you're working a couple of sides of the ball at the same time rather than just the one thing. And as coaches, we know we're time poor. So we need, you know, we need to be able to have drills or activities that are working on more than one thing at a time to get more value out of our session.
Yep. And if you can close it in the half court or the full court, they'll directly translate to each other, which is a big part of what we're doing in that world. It's like the closeout does tend to break down most teams' defensive structures. I do find, because the closeout with hands down or a lead foot or, you know, from 5-6 feet away when the shot can obviously go up. So that working on the closeout part is a vital part of it. Like, one of the drills I've seen you do in the past, though, is dividing your half court up into thirds. And playing literally as if that is in the back court, ball in the back court, keep it there, pin it there, try and stop it from just being advanced. another offensive player at half court. So it's one on two. Another offensive player at half court. When they put their hands up, the offensive player has to pick the ball up and make that pass. Now, they have to pick the ball up off the dribble, though. And that's the goal, is to try and make that pass, which I know is about to hit on an area that you've spoken about too, Bestie, is that ability to play with the live basketball and find the pass is really vital when you're pressured in particular, and being able to play off both hands with a pivot, those types of things. So it's an easy way of just segmenting your court out in the half court. If you are trying to work on full court work, as you say, play it back to half court. So the geography is similar, but just segmenting that thing out just is a really easy way, because that will now start to work on your backcourt ball pressure. It'll start to work on your guard having to play with two players and effectively keep their dribble alive, because I know you're very anti-spin dribble, or that reverse dribble,
yes.
Zoe, on that. So it'll stop that from happening. It'll start teaching them to make the pass off the bounce. I took it a step further at the under 14 FTP stuff that we were doing. We were doing the same drill. So something that you do with your 16s and 18s, we were doing with our 13s and 14s effectively, that when the pass went, both players had to go and touch the basketball to the person that was receiving it, then get back as the ball was getting passed back. So we started to add in the closeout to go with that. And you can just start to layer it up. You know, there's really easy ways to do it. But I'll stop talking and throw over the Bestie on this one, because passing off the bounce in particular was one of the things that you saw over the weekend too.
Yeah, I think everywhere we see it, you know, people, when they're pressured, they tend to dribble to a spot and pick the ball up. You know, like maybe it's the sideline. Most of the time it's the sideline they dribble to and then just pick the ball up. Or they'll, you know, dribble to a corner. If it's under 12s, that'd be the right-hand corner, I would say, right? But, you know, like dribbling to a spot and then just picking it up is an issue, you know. And it's all times of things, you know, like they've got to be able to beat their player one-on-one and create time and space and all that. But, you know, the rest of the team has to, you know, leading and getting open, screening for their teammates to get open and all that is important. But quite often by the time the other action is run or whatever and the person is open for the shot, we take too long to deliver the pass and then the advantage is gone, which is what Zoe was talking about earlier. So it's important to be able to do it off the bounce, be able to dribble off the bounce, pass with both hands, and not, you know, like get it there, but get it there on time and get it there, you know, in their pocket and all that stuff. It's a real issue. Like I saw it, you know, and I will say this again, like the 18s final, you know, both teams were running some pretty good stuff, you know, like it looked like basketball. But there was like someone ripping off an away screen or whatever, and it was like the pass was just late. And you're like, oh, and it's because they've had to pick it up or you know.
Or switch hands.
Yeah, that type of stuff. And it's like, you know, and then the person would end up just shooting a tough one.
You know? Clock winding down. Yeah. Lucky it's going up.
Yeah, or maybe not clock winding down. Yep. But yeah, yeah. But it's just, you know, that skill, it's, you know, it's huge.
Yeah, I'm dealing with it at the moment with the 13s and 14s kids, and we are trying to get them to make more passes off the bounce and with the opposite hand. And it's amazing how many kids just default back to second hand on the ball, trying to make that pass. And look, there's a time and a place for it, for sure, where you want to make that two-handed pass a little bit more secure, all those types of things. But the reality is the ball will move far quicker if they can catch with one, pass with one, those types of things. How do you go about correcting the errors or keeping your cool a little bit, I suppose, too, Zoe, when it doesn't work and you can see they're getting frustrated? Like, what cues do you use dealing with the players in that space?
So in that particular drill that you were just talking about, because it's borderline impossible to dribble one versus two, to dribble from baseline to halfway. So the incentive is if the pass gets to the receiver on the full and no deflections, then they can take two as big steps as they want forward to advance them towards the halfway line. If not, it goes back to them where they were and they just continue with the drill.
And it's a brutal drill.
It's like brutal. God.
The mental frustration you see with some kids that get really close and get it deflected. And it's like, oh, I've got to go again.
And
like
now this is where I could be wrong, but when those errors happen, it's deflected or it doesn't get there on the full, my reaction to it is whatever it is. So it's deflected, back where you were, and just then probably walk off, to be honest, because there's nothing I can really teach or show. This has to be reps. This has to be, you know, they need to sort of figure this out for themselves. We talk about at the start of the drill what's going to help them, you know, change of pace, eyes forward, not turning our back, creating space against the D and then trying to attack maybe the slower defender or, you know, what. So we talk about that, but then that's up within the drill, it's up to them to try and figure that out. So, and you do see, I actually ran this drill at a coaching course. I was presenting a coaching course and it actually made one of the participants quite upset, which can happen. But it's got to be a case of you just got to fight through it a little bit. And to be honest, if you want to be a point guard or you want to be even a player, you don't have to be a point guard. You have to be able to make these passes so you can get upset about it or you can make your adjustments. And generally the adjustments are exactly what Bestie was saying. You know, being able to get it off the bounce and straight from there, because the window of time that the pass is open is quite small. So you've got to be able to not only see it, but then gather it with one hand and hit them on target on time. And it's not easy. And so it's just, yeah, it's just building up those reps. And there's layers to that drill. If anybody wants to see it, I suppose I could film it on Saturday and we could put it up on Insta or whatever. But yeah, it is brutal. But sometimes you've got to let them sit in that frustration a little bit to get them to make genuine change.
Yep, I like it. The last one we had on the list was pre and post practice. So what that looks like, Bestie. So do you want to talk us through that?
Yeah, I just think, you know, in this age where kids are doing a lot, you know, they're rolling from one thing to the next, often just, you know, the importance for us as coaches to, you know, make sure they're warming up properly, they're cooling down properly, they're, you know, words about, you know, we're speaking a lot now, you know, practice ends, why are you walking outside with your jersey on and nothing else because it's like freezing, you know, like, you know, that
type. Oh, but I'm hot now.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. You know, that type of stuff. So, yeah, I just think, you know, we've got it to a point now with our STP programs where the kids do the warm-up 2.0. They're pretty self-sufficient in it, you know. The morning session, sometimes we have to give them a little bit of encouragement to perhaps, you know, do it at a speed that's going to work for them. But, you know, it really matters. It really, really matters, that stuff. So I think the pre-practice is not only the physical stuff though. So we've spoken to our Wednesday night group about, our coaches have our pre-practice meeting and we talk about, you know, I'm going to do this and you're in charge of blockouts and you're in charge of denying the kick ahead or whatever it might be, you know. And we've encouraged our players to start to, you know, meet positionally, what's important for them, you know, that type of stuff. So before, you know, the coach actually calls, like, you know, blows a whistle and bring it in, you know, what are they doing beforehand? Are they thinking about practice? Are they preparing themselves physically? Are they preparing themselves mentally? Like all of that stuff. And the same goes for after practice, you know. Are they reflective? You know, are they, you know, writing it down? Are they talking to their peers? Are they maybe asking their coach? Whatever it is. Do they get their cool down in properly? You know, like, are they tidying up the gym? Are they putting their basketballs away? Like all that stuff. It's all like encompassing.
And it's the same sort of thing. Like, I know obviously you deal with a lot of country athletes, Zoe, who have got potentially an hour car ride in or out.
That's if, like, they're lucky.
If, yeah, well, in some cases, significantly longer. So how important is it for them to make sure that they're on top of this, but also that you allow them time to be on top of this?
Yeah, and to be honest, we have to sacrifice a little bit of playing or training time to get it done. And as much as you feel like, oh, like I really want that extra 5 minutes, or like, at the end of the day, what are you going to get done in that 5 minutes anyway? That well,
and
is,
would you rather have your player for the next 4 weeks because they're
that,
not
that
injured?
Is more valuable than the physical well-being of your athletes. So, yeah, being able to take that time is really, really important, and make sure that they understand how important it is, because, you know, a lot of the time, in the beginning when I was first sort of stepping into this high performance world, I'd look at all the warm up and cool down and, oh, we never did that and we're fine. And then, you know, I wake up in the morning and I've said it on the pod before, I'm like the evolution of man poster for the first, you know, 15 minutes. Like
until the ibuprofen kicks in.
So maybe there's something to it. because one of the really important things, and it's something I try and explain to the athletes a lot, is it's not it is about your basketball and being in peak physical condition, but there's a lot of life post basketball where, you know, massive injuries can take a toll on you and can stay with you for the rest of your life. So, you know, it's not just about the now. It's also about how you're able to then physically cope after you move on from basketball.
Yep, I like it a lot. Thank you both for jumping in. That does wrap us up for today. We do have about four or five others, so there might end up being a part two to this somewhere down the line.
Bestie, we got a part two.
Oh, don't be too excited yet. I've only got three, so we might have to flesh that out a little bit more. But thank you both for jumping in. Fantastic to have you both in again. Coaches, good luck on whenever you play your games effectively or when you're listening to this. Hopefully this does give you a few more resources and a little bit of a guide. By the way, one of the ones is more shooting at practice. Coops can sleep happier tonight that we have at least mentioned it, if nothing
else. Wait till he gets back for that.
Yeah,
one.
We might have to more than anything else. Coaches, thanks very much. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.